Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Emission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight we are discussing the recent FX miniseries, Fosse Verdon. Now, this is pretty much going to be our most recent series we've ever done. This was in April and May of 2019 on FX, and it concerns the life and career of director-choreographer Bob Fosse and dancer-choreographer and partner, well, I say not just creative partner, but also off again, on again partner in life, Gwen Verdon. Joining me tonight are Carl Kafer and Aaron White. Say hello.
Greetings, salutations.
Hello.
So, you know, this is, you know, like I said, this is a newer series. So we'll start with you, Carl. How did you find out about this one?
I saw the ads and immediately was captivated because I'm such a huge Bob Fosse fan, also, I had, when I was very, very young, we would take daily, you know, Saturday trips for a matinee into New York City, I got to see Sweet Charity when I was 7, and I got to see How to Succeed in Business at 8, both directed by Fosse, and of course, the previous one, Charity, was also starred Gwen Verdon. So, I mean, I had to watch this. There's just no way around it.
Mm-hmm. So what about you, Aaron?
I saw the ads, noticed all the awards attention. Am a big fan of Michelle Williams and Sam Rockwell, and have an interest. I can't call myself a fan of Bob Fosse. I've not seen enough of his work, but I have an interest in him. I think he's an interesting character. It was one I wanted to get to, but didn't really have time. And during quarantine, they had it on sale for really cheap on the iTunes store. So I was able to get it and check it out finally.
Yeah, I saw it right after it aired. I saw it right after it got, because it aired, and then about 6 weeks after it aired, it got nominated for a shit ton of Emmys. And I immediately, having missed it when it aired, and kicking myself because I knew it was good, because I wanted to see it, it got all this acclaim, I immediately went and did a digital purchase, which I rarely do digital purchases. I don't mind digital rentals, but digital purchases I'm real iffy on. This time I did that, and I was so happy that I did, and I was just pulling for it in a lot of categories. But that was a rare great year in at the Emmys, because you also had Chernobyl, which we're going to have to do a show on that in a few months, and you also had When They See Us, which was about the Central Park Five. You know, this is just one of the great seasons for TV miniseries 2018-2019, and for this series to stand out in such a crowd was, for me, an extraordinary achievement. I do want to ask, you know, this is history rather than, you know, like a literary adaptation, even though it is based on a biography by Sam Wasson. A relatively thick tome, considering that Fosse died so young, and the book is something like, I think, 800 pages long, 600 pages long. I don't have a copy on hand right now, but the question is, as a series, as a work of television art or entertainment, does this have a theme? Carl?
I really don't think so. Simply because it's focusing on this relationship, and so the theme is the characters themselves and mm-hmm. who they are and how they interact and how, you know, through all the travails and that, they stuck together to a certain degree. They both recognize, and I guess maybe in terms of artist and muse, but which one was the artist and which one was the muse, because they were both muses as far as I'm concerned. That's what I would say. I don't think there's an overarching theme, though.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that, because one of my favorite episodes is episode 5, which is a bottle episode set at a beach house during a storm, where the characters are Bob Fosse, Gwen Verdon, Patty Chayefsky, Neil Simon, Anne Reinking, and Fosse and Verdon's daughter,
Nicole.
And, you know, this is just an incredible array of historical talent, great characters, great actors all around. And it really gets, I think, to as close to a theme, or at least a through line, which is something that you kind of pointed to, which is, you know, who's the muse? But to me, it's how they both pushed and pulled each other, both because they needed it and because the other really required it. These were two very egotistical people, two very needy people, people who didn't want to need one another artistically or personally. But while they could both have been successful without the other, it wouldn't have been the same, and as history proves, it wasn't. Their best work was always, always when the other was involved in some small way. So, you know, that's what I have to say about it. So what about you, Aaron?
I agree with the sentiments. I would, though, say that the overarching themes are obsession and addiction, and the way that we can be addicted to a person more than we can love them, and that the toxicity of their relationship is actually what caused the great art. And they were obsessed and they were addicted, and through that tension and through that, through the just really kind of gross relationship they had, which was loving at times, but was very much not loving most of the time, they created some truly titanic art. And it's nuanced in a way towards people with these kind of issues that we don't get to see too often. Either most of the time we're either giving blind praise or blind hate towards artists with these issues. And it showed us how ugly this was, but it also showed us, reminded us that this is art that mattered too. So, that as well.
Yeah. So, you know, this brings me to my next question. Do you think that someone needs to be familiar with the history of the people involved in order to appreciate the show? You know, for me, I don't think you do, but I think it definitely enriches the experience, just like I think it does with any good historical accounting. And this is really good. For me, it's really good historical work. So at least in terms of, you know, I hate to call it, you know, some sort of a biodrama, but it essentially is biodrama. But it seems so far beyond what we think of that, like in terms of, oh, I mean, Gandhi and Amadeus are good movies, but it doesn't seem as trite as that. So, Carl, what about you? What do you think? Do you think that you need to be familiar with it, or that the show really does give you everything you need and it just helps?
That really, for me, is a tough question. Simply because I was so inundated with both of them when I was young, and I knew exactly who they were, and so I can't really, you know, step away from that knowledge. To me, I think you need to know, but that's because I knew. You know, I'm not looking at it. I think one of the things that the show does is it does get into much more detail, which interested me and made my interest peak during the whole series. You know, the idea of that Burton was coming on to help him with the editing of Lenny, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, there are certain things that certainly, you know, are surprising and that maybe you don't need to know. But I think at least you have to have an idea of how impactful these people were.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you don't have that sense, then why are we watching a show about them for eight hours? Eight episodes.
Yep. So, Aaron?
I know a lot less about them going into it than I do now. I think that you need to have a passing awareness of something that they did. For example, I went into it with a deep appreciation of Cabaret. I love Cabaret. And so I went into it with that and a very, very basic understanding that Bob Fosse was a huge personality, a huge, great artist, that he lived hard, died young, all of that stuff, but did not know really much about the specifics of it. And was able to just let it wash over me. So I think it's like any, like, you don't watch the special features of a movie before you watch the movie. I think you should go into it with some background knowledge, some knowledge of at least some of their major work. But I don't think you need to be, like, experts by any means to understand this. They do lay out a very thorough goings on of this relationship.
Yeah. So sticking to this aspect, you know, did this make you appreciate Fosse and Verdon's work more, Carl?
Again, I have to say no to that because I already like truly appreciated both of them.
So did it change or alter or deepen or give you something new to think about?
Certainly it gave me some new information, which deepened my appreciation perhaps of Burton. But I have to say something about Gwen. When she got away from theater, and she did do a lot of TV, she won 3 Emmys for TV for guest spots. And of course they don't get into that in the show, but I remember her seeing her on an Equalizer episode and numerous other things, and I always thought she was really, really good, no matter whether or not she was a hoofer and dancer and singer, or whether she was a straight actress. Either way.
Well, remember, she was. I think she had an episode of Homicide. I know that around the time Fosse passed away, she did her little bit. Now, this is not television, but she was she played Gears' character's mother in The Cotton Club.
Right. You know, and the thing is, you know, I think as far as Burden, it did give me more of an appreciation of her. As far as Posse, at one point we're going to be talking about the elephant in the room, but Posse, I already basically knew because he told me what he thought of himself. And that's a particular film we'll get into.
Yeah. So, Aaron, what about you?
As I mentioned with Fosse, I was familiar with, you know, his landmark films. I still need to see Lenny. I'm very curious after seeing this to see Lenny. Actually, it was always kind of a get to it to when I get to it kind of deal. But now I'm very curious to see that one. But it also made me curious to see some of his notable flops, like the film adaptation of Sweet Charity, or what was it, Playhouse 78 or what, 81, whatever that movie is called, which they don't get into. But
thank you.
It sounds interesting now. But I agree with Carl. What it really did was make me more interested in seeing more Verdon's work, who mm-hmm. is not as notable now as she was at the time this took place. Because most of her work was on Broadway and is not preserved the way a film actress would be preserved. We can talk about her as one of the great actresses of all time, but we can't really prove it because what's her film legacy? As you mentioned, Cotton Club, where she in the new encore edition has less than 5 minutes of screen time, and that's greatly brought up from the original cut. So there's
she gets a whole new whopping 30 seconds of important footage added. And granted, it actually does make an impact, but holy shit.
It is important footage. It's just that it's not much. And so I mean, she has a legacy still because it's still recent history. But what happens when that recent history becomes ancient history and there's no record of her? Because for the most part, she did not do well in Hollywood for whatever reason. So it has made me more curious about her and what of her work I can see.
Yeah. So, you know, and to kind of wrap up this section, I'll throw this to Carl first. What specifically does this tell the audience about Fosse or Verdon as artists?
That they were committed basically only to their art, particularly Fosse. I mean, Fosse, as you tell throughout this miniseries, not the nicest person in the world.
No.
Okay? The man was an asshole. Okay? And Burden put up with it. There's, you know, as far as artists, I mean, the one thing that I think the miniseries really does well is recreating the iconic moments on stage, particularly for Burden. And you can see it. And there's that one section, there's a number of sections where you talk about Lenny, right? You have Sam Rockwell as Fosse doing Lenny. And I thought that was really interesting. They did some really interesting things with that, but the whole point of showing the art so that, as you say, it's now represented. It might not be Burden, but it's supposed to be Burden.
Right.
Right? Yeah. And so now we have some sort of touchstone that we can say, that's what it was supposed to be like. So at least we have that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I
Michelle
know
Williams
Go on.
I was just emphasizing, like, Michelle Williams' performance here as Verdon, the fact that she was giving us Verdon's performances to some degree. I'm just kind of reemphasizing Carl's point there.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. So the next one that I want to ask is, you know, beyond the Tullys, who we definitely will get to next, beyond those two leads, who deserves singling out? I mean, Jesus Christ, where do you begin? You know, is it Norbert Leo Butz as Paddy Chayefsky? Is it the guy that played Neil Simon, whose name now escapes me, Nate Caudry? Is it, you know, Margaret Qualley as Anne Rankin? Is it either of the two ladies that played the daughter? Is it Norbert, you know, again Norbert Leo Butz as Paddy Chayefsky, which is phenomenal. Is there someone else? Paul Reiser as Sid Fear or Cy Fear. So, you know, the list goes on and on. I mean, this is an incredible cast, folks. So, for you, Carl, beyond those two leads, anyone that you think deserves singling out?
Oh, without a doubt, Norman Leo Butz as Chayefsky.
Yeah, especially that just for the way he said, when Pogrom comes down Fifth Avenue, then you'll know. Then you'll know when Pogrom comes down Fifth Avenue.
Right. And I mean, there's so many good people in that, but he just absolutely nailed it for me. And as you said, I tell you someone else, too. Okay, when you get into the films and the things, Kelly Barrett had played Liza Minnelli. Bianca,
yeah, she was actually
Marquin,
really good.
That's who I was going to mention.
Bianca Marquin, who played Cheetah Rivera. Seriously, the two girls that played Nicole Fosse. You know, just amazing. You know, Evan Handler is Hal Prince. You know, I mean, they were really, really good. But I'd have to say, without a doubt, Norman Butz and I would also say Bianca Marquin, who I thought did a magnificent job as Cheetah Rivera in that section.
Yep. So over to you, Aaron.
You nailed it with Kelly Barrett in my mind. I think her Liza Minnelli was incredible.
Yeah, agreed.
I think Margaret Qualley as Anne Rankin was great. She's been shooting up the notable young actress lists for a couple of years now. And this is definitely her most meaty role. And I cannot find the name. I'm not digging too deep, but the name's escaping me. The guy who played Dustin Hoffman in The Clips of Lenny was very good, considering that he's recreating footage that exists as one of the greatest actors of the generation at the peak of his powers.
I just found the name, Brandon Jacob Uranowitz.
Thank you. I had looked it up before and forgotten it. He was outstanding. There were a couple of moments early on when I was like, that's not Dustin Hoffman, but I can only tell by his face. He was outstanding. So those three. And I agree once again that the people who were doing parts that we have actual footage of, they all did outstanding work, not just recreating that work, but interpreting it as their own while also being faithful to the original footage.
Excuse me. Live radio, folks. Live radio. And no Rona. Just needed a little water. So what about those two leads, though? Seriously, let's talk about it. Sam Rockwell and Michelle Williams. Two people that I already had a hell of a lot of respect for. Two people that won tons of acclaim and awards for this and are quite heralded throughout their career. But even so, especially in the case of Williams, you know, I knew she was great. But goddamn, I didn't know she was this good. And I knew she was great, but I didn't know she could do this. And, you know, Rockwell, I mean, he just adds to the legend with this. I mean, he's so convincing as Fosse, just like Williams is so convincing as Verdon, that for me, you watch this and you forget that you're watching someone play these characters. You just think of them as these people. You know, you almost can convince yourself that Fosse and Verdon came back to play themselves here. At least that's how convincing it was for me. What about for you, Carl?
Oh, well, both of them, I think did marvelous. Now, I have been a Sam Rockwell fan for years. And, I mean, seriously, years. One of his first things, he was actually on an Equalizer that I remember. And he just played a quick 2-3 lines. And I looked and I said, I got to keep an eye on him. But, I mean, he's worked for Paul Schrader. He's done all this wonderful work, basically as a supporting actor. And then, of course, Moon came along, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and he's come into his own as a true one of the great actors of his generation. And for him to
you know,
do
I
this,
have to say, I'm glad you mentioned, let me interrupt to say, I'm glad you mentioned Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, because I know that film gets some flack in certain quarters, but I don't understand the hate for it. I think that's a brilliant movie and a brilliant performance, and that's where I was like, okay, this is absolutely someone that I don't think is ever going to be a reason for me not to watch a movie. You know, there are very few actors that I will watch a movie for, but there are tons like Will Ferrell or Adam Sandler or that crowd that if I see they're in something, they may be a reason for me to avoid a film. And
right.
Sam Rockwell is not in that category.
Well,
he's also close to being in that category of I will watch the movie because he's in it.
Oh, absolutely. The movie that absolutely made me say yeah, gotta watch anything he's in was The Green Mile.
Yep.
And he has a supporting role, and he's like one of the nastiest sons of bitches you've ever seen.
Oh,
when he
plays Percy, oh, you're talking about? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's horrible. In the best way.
Man, that motherfucker.
And then Galaxy Quest, for God's sake. He follows up the Green Mile with Galaxy Quest. Two completely different, you know, people from different universes. And he nails them both.
Well, and then he followed Galaxy Quest up with the aforementioned Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. And you're like, okay, this guy's just... He's here.
You know, and Michelle Williams, you know, I mean, I don't know her as well, but, you know, you talk about her Marilyn Monroe, which I thought was absolutely fantastic.
Yep. And let's not forget that he also did Rockwell. Let's not forget that he did Zaphod Beeblebrox in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
This is true. This is true. Michelle Williams, you know, I'm trying to think. Is it Meek's Cutoff? No, it's Blue Valentine.
Yeah.
And
well, she did do Meek's Cutoff with I just forgot the lady's
Riker.
Name, but Kelly Riker, who did last year one of last year's best films, First Cow.
She right. actually did several films with Riker where. You were just waiting for both of them to get the recognition, like Meek's Cutoff, Certain Women, Wendy and Lucy, just a string of them together. And where is the recognition here?
Yeah. And
especially
another one I want to mention
with First Cow last year. That pissed me off.
Yeah. The one I do want to mention that's forgotten in a lot of ways is Take This Waltz, which was directed by Sarah Pauley. And that's a fantastic film.
Yeah, Sarah Pauley, she hasn't done a lot of movies as a director, but the ones she's done are really special.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. But you know, Michelle Williams, I may not know her as well, but I can tell you this, after watching Fosse Verdon, I'll watch any goddamn thing she's in. Period.
Mm-hmm. So what about you, Aaron?
Well, here's my confession. I am a big fan of Michelle Williams going back to the Dawson Creek days, where she's the only one who really survived the transition to being a grown-up in anything other than self-character. I think we said enough about Sam Rockwell. He's incredible. Well, actually, I want to add one tidbit. In his review of the Chuck Palahniuk film Choke, Roger Ebert said that Sam Rockwell was his generation's Christopher Walken, which is both high praise, and he has avoided falling off the cliff into self-parody the way Walken has. But I think it's a really apt comparison when Walken's at his best, in that both of them can make really weird stuff feel real.
Yeah.
And can bring an intensity to a quiet intensity to anything they do.
Yeah, and it's not, and everybody points to, you know, the gold watch scene in, as they should, in Pulp Fiction. But, you know, honestly, that role that he had in Catch Me If You Can, that's a really tricky role to pull off properly, and he really helps ground that movie.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Williams is perhaps... She's certainly, like, one of the greatest actresses born in the 1980s, if not the best. And a couple weeks ago when we were doing our show on Angels in America, Sydney said that was the point that she realized that they should just give Meryl Streep all the Oscars all the time. That's kind of where I am with Michelle Williams. Like, how hasn't she won an Oscar yet? She was the best supporting actress in 2005, as far as I'm concerned. No offense, Rachel Wise, but Michelle Williams in Brokeback Mountain was incredible. Her performance as Marilyn Monroe and in Blue Valentine were incredibly heartbreaking. Her turn in Manchester by the Sea... would have won Best Supporting Actress had Viola Davis not committed perhaps the biggest case of category fraud that I've ever seen, because her role in Fences is not only a lead role, it's the lead role.
In Fences.
Yeah.
She's the last person standing in that. What can you say? She's one of the best working actresses today. She's one of the best actresses of her generation. And, oh, this is what I can say. Not only was she incredible as Gwen Verdon, she also convinced me that they need to do her as Judy Garland.
You know, I'm gonna say this. I saw. It's interesting you say that because I saw Zellweger as Garland after, of course, seeing this. And the whole time I was watching that movie, I was like, shit, they should have just gotten Michelle Williams to do this. I'd have rather watched her take on it. And that's not to say that I think that Zellweger did a bad job in that movie. I'm not particularly fond of Zellweger in general. She was okay in that movie, and, you know, the movie itself is harmless, but
she was pretty good in the bad movie.
Yeah, but I can't help but think that a better actress and perhaps a director who knew what to do with the material a little more interestingly might not have made for a better film. Like, who knows? I mean, hey, how about Michelle Williams directed by Kelly Reichardt in a movie about Judy Garland? Maybe that would have gotten them both the recognition they deserve. You know, now, and we're blazing through these questions, is this good history, this series? Carl?
I actually think it is. I think it's well-researched. I think one of the problems I have with the adaptation is it seems to be a little one-note in their personal relationship. It seems to focus on the darkness, which of course is tantamount to it, but it just seems it hits the same notes a lot. But as far as history, as far what happened and all that, I think it's particularly good.
Yeah, well, I have to say that, you know, I think that your point about it being a little one note, I think it's a little more than one note. But if you have an issue with it, then you may be that you might have an issue with the source work, which is Fosse by Sam Wasson, which really does follow a through line of the almost abusive dependency on one another, the devouring dependency on the other that they seem to have, and that is something that comes up over and over again as you read that tome. So, Aaron, what about you?
I'm going to say something that's not going to make sense to some people who haven't studied history. This is great facts. It's not great history because it's not meant to be. This is presented as a piece of memory. It's presented in a really messy way, which is how we remember things. That's not how history works. History is a straight line. History has a thesis that it's trying to convince the reader of, and this isn't mm-hmm. that. This is scattershot. This is this particular moment happened because of this thing that happened a long time ago, but it's also because of this, and this. And it's yep. much more stream of consciousness than it is history. So forgive me. I'm being a little pretentious here. And if anyone
as a fellow historian, I have to say that you have a point, and that's a very von Ronkian take on it.
Yeah, I will agree. Like, if somebody says it's good history, I'm not going to disagree with them. But since we're discussing this more in depth here, I am going to take a moment to say this. because I think it's important because it for I mean for it being grounded in facts, and most of these are undisputed facts. This is very relentlessly researched. But at the end of the day, it's a work of art, and it's supposed to.
So would you agree then that it's more factual than historical?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I think that's fair. The next one then is, and I'll take, and this is related. So how does this work as entertainment, Carl?
I think it does quite well. I think it does quite well. I do think that certain people might be turned off about the true darkness that you see here. But I don't find that the characters, again, the one note thing, I think that hurts it a bit. But that being said, you watch this and you see those numbers recreated, you see the acting in front of you, you see all of that, and the care behind this that Lin-Manuel does and everybody involved is very apparent. Very apparent. And mm-hmm. I think it does quite well.
So what about you, Aaron?
I think that it's entertaining. I think that it definitely walks a line where it's in constant danger of not being entertaining. It's definitely a work of art, but I'm not sure it's always supposed to entertain. Because as Carl said, it is dark. And I think that if you find some of the material here entertaining, you're a sick pup. But as a whole, I think it is entertaining. I think that the way they incorporate Fosse's work and Verdon's work help it in that way. I think it's entertaining, but I think that it's always in danger of not being, which is great. I think it makes for great tension.
So, is this more a triumph of writing, directing, or acting? Carl?
I have to go with acting. I really do have to go with acting. I just think what they do as far as everybody involved, and particularly the two leads, is just pretty friggin' amazing. Seriously.
Yeah. So, Aaron?
I can't argue the acting. I think that the direction gets sold short, though. As I mentioned, this is awfully close to being a work of stream of consciousness, which is very hard to hold together, especially over almost 9 hours. And 8 episodes. And I think that if, what is it? I think 4 directors, 1 main director, and then 3 one-episodes each, something like that. I think that if they let go even a little bit, that it spirals into chaos. Excuse me. I don't know what happened to my voice. So I think that the direction here is really undersold because of what a triumph in acting it is. So I'm not going to say it's not I think that if you're ranking the three that you have to put acting at the top of the list, but also and that the directing is so the most short.
Yeah, and you know, and we'll get into that director because the director is a very important figure here in a minute. But you know, usually I like to do this towards the end of it. But where do we rank this thing all time among miniseries, Carl?
I'm not going to answer that. I don't know yet. I think it's good. But I don't think it's outstanding. I certainly think it's worthwhile. But I can't, you know, middle, it's better than middle of the road, but it's not, you know, the most incredible thing I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah, no. What about you, Aaron?
I currently have it working just outside the top 10 of my miniseries. I say lurking because on some days it truly is battling to get in, and on some days it's just really comfortable where it's at. It keeps looking over Brideshead Revisited's shoulder and kind of licking his chops like a bit bad wolf. But it hasn't made a move yet.
Yeah. I have it at number 285 on my top 300. Now, that does not mean that I don't like it at all. I actually really, really love it. It's just, as Carl said, it's very new. And as you said, you know, it's one of those ones that you have to kind of think about a while and let it sit. So I really do think that it's one where it could move up, but I don't think I'm ever going to consider this as like a top 10 or even a top 20 miniseries. But that really speaks more to the quality of everything else rather than anything insanely wrong with this, because, you know, no show that is this well produced and this well directed and this well acted can possibly, you know, be looked at as bad or unworthy. I certainly think that within its television season of 2018-2019, it was one of the top three. It's a fantastic... Yeah. It's a fantastic show, but...
Yeah.
No, and that was all I was going to say. It's a fantastic show, but...
The fact that it didn't win the Emmy or Golden Globe or any of the things for Best Miniseries, and the ones that won were deserving, speaks to the quality of that series, that season in that category.
Yeah. So, you know, now the director of this, and there were a few directors for this, but the main director here was Thomas Kail. Now, Thomas Kail is Michelle Williams' husband, but he is best known for being the director of the off-Broadway and Broadway productions of two shows that I'm sure nobody listening to the show will have ever heard about. Some guy named Lin-Manuel Miranda and his shows In the Heights and Hamilton. So, yeah. And, of course, Miranda was one of the producers on this. And Kail directed episodes 1, 2, 5, 7, and 8. So he was a major force in this. And of course, you know, Miranda himself appeared in a small role as Roy Scheider portraying the Bob Fosse character in all that jazz when they showed all that
truly
jazz at the end.
Truly an inception moment.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep. So, you know, and the other directors were, because they deserve to be noticed, Adam Bernstein, Jessica Yu, and Minky Spiro. So, you know, this is a quality show. This is something that, you know, if you have an interest in theater or film, television, theatrical history, you know, if you just love great performances, if you love an evocation of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, fuck, watch it. It's great. So, you know, I mean, and that brings me to my next question. Carl, are you familiar at all with Cale and Miranda's work? I mean, I know you've certainly heard of it, but have you seen
no,
In the Heights,
have
or
not.
Have you watched
no,
the,
not.
The,
not
the
not
film Hamilton, version of Hamilton yet?
Nope.
Okay. Well, what about you, Aaron?
I have seen parts of Hamilton. I was not able to see all of it to this point.
Well, too bad.
Yeah, what I've seen is excellent.
Yep.
I did also see parts of his Grease Live. Is it NBC who does those, the live musicals, a couple times a year?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Grease is the best amongst kind of and I don't like Grease, so that's saying something.
Yeah.
So he's again like Verdon, he's more of a Broadway guy than a film and television guy. He's just now starting to really break into to film and television. Lin-Manuel Miranda, obviously, everybody's familiar with him. Perhaps the most important person working on Broadway right now.
yeah.
And then the show was developed by Cale and, is it Stephen Levinson?
Yes.
I think so.
Yeah, Stephen Levinson, who wrote the book for the Paul and Palfick show, Dear Evan Hansen, which was one of the great musicals recently. Also, he wrote the book and screenplay, not the book because movies don't have books, wrote the screenplay for the film version, which is coming out later this year. So these are guys who are in their late 30s, early 40s for the most part, who produced Fosse Verdon, who are just now starting to use that Broadway cachet and start to flex their muscles in Hollywood. In the Heights is coming out as a... I guess, for lack of a better term, real movie.
And it looks so good.
This year as well. It does look great. So these are guys that have been known for a while in their circles, but their circles are expanding. And Fosse Verdon was one of the major catalysts to that cachet being turned into credit. Because Hamilton got them in the door, and then Fosse Verdon was like, okay, you know how to handle film. And so let's give you a movie. Let's see what you can do.
Yep, and I think if In the Heights does well, that we will eventually see a filmed version of Hamilton, even though I don't know if anything is ever going to compare to the filmed production of those two Broadway performances that they captured for the Hamill film, as they call it, that Disney Plus has, which I understand is still due out on Blu-ray this fall. I will be picking up a copy of that. We've talked about them, but now I know that, Carl, you want to talk a little bit more about Fosse's career, and I know you have a big old love letter to all that jazz that you want to say.
Well, the one thing I have to say about Fosse Verdon, and they do, and I think this is about hitting the same notes, because there's a number of things that are very similar to all that jazz, and if anyone has not seen all that jazz, it is necessary. Seriously, it is probably one of the top three greatest, certainly top five greatest film musicals of all time. But the thing about all that jazz, and they do reference it in Fosse Verdon with that scene with Nicole, where you know he talks about her dance and she sees it as he's filming it. All that jazz is Bob Fosse looking at his life saying, I'm a fucking asshole and I deserve to die. That is what that movie is. There's no doubt about it. And for me, the honesty of that film surpasses quite a bit what we see in Fosse Verdon. Simply because he's being that hard on himself. And he knows how much of an asshole he is. And I think there's a lot to that. Fosse Verdon, to me, is sort of like puts a little bit of gauze on it, whereas all that jazz is just like, it's just... You just see it right in front of you, and the whole thing about the repetition of the pills, which you also see in Fosse Verdon, there's more of a rhythm to it and things. But that film to me is Fosse's masterpiece. It's his masterpiece, and there's so much influence of that film on Fosse Verdon that it was almost sort of just slightly difficult for me to separate the two. And maybe you think I'm completely out of line here, but I don't think so.
I agree that after they did Cabaret, that it seemed like it was rushing to get to all that jazz at times.
One exception is probably that fifth episode
where everything stops,
and that's probably to me why I love that episode so fucking much, because you've been at that breakneck pace, which is great in some ways in episodes 3 and 4, but my God, you need to slow down.
Yeah, agreed.
And that may be an issue with the script, because, you know, you mentioned the script, and I don't think it has a bad script, but I definitely think that the acting and the direction are what is notable here. Do I think the writing is more than serviceable? Yeah, especially in that fifth episode. I think there's some really beautiful paralleling going on there, but, you know... The film does have some pacing issues that I do actually blame on the script, not the director.
Right.
Aaron, anything you have to say about Fosse's career or Verdon's career before we move into the final little wrap up here?
I just really want to mention that it's a pity that he died before he could make this film version of Chicago. because I think that it would have been a lot better.
Yeah. And I don't think it's a bad movie. I just think that, you know.
Exactly. It's good. It's fine for what it is. I have no issues with it, but it's not Fosse. It's not the guy who made All That Jazz and Cabaret.
No.
Nope.
It's Rob Marshall instead.
Yeah. And, you know, Rob Marshall did give us a wonderful version of Annie, let's be honest. But,
And he also fucked up Nine, too. Let's not forget that.
Yes, he did.
I still haven't seen that shit. but
gotcha,
that's another
Adam,
topic.
Gotcha.
But, you know, so, Carl, we're at that point of the show where we do housekeeping. So, anything coming up on Deviant Legion?
Oh, good God. What isn't coming up on Deviant Legion? Number one, we're going to be officially announcing our Patreon and our sponsor here very, very soon. And we'll be, we actually have a meeting tomorrow on that, where we're going to really like look at things. So that's upcoming. On Saturday, tomorrow, it's a very special day. It's May Day. And we're going to celebrate it in doing a celebration and in memoriam of Sergeant Howie. And we have all sorts of footage from Summer Isle, and we'll be doing a commentary watch on The Wicker Man, the original one, which is available on Amazon Prime. And we'll be doing that tomorrow. On Tuesday, for ISF podcast, that is up in the air yet. I'm hoping to do, we were going to do a Richard Rush episode, but our guest had to go to the hospital. So I'm hoping to reschedule that. On Thursday next week, we have a memorial to Felix Sela with Todd Sheets. Felix, if you don't know the name, I'll just say two words, Cousin It. Also, Tweaky from the original Battlestar Galactica. And to me, he will always be Meskimata from the Manitou. And so we'll be doing a show about Felix, who passed away. I also want to just give my regards. I just found out another friend of mine that I worked with in the 1980s at the 13th Street Theater passed away a couple days ago. And that would be Ed Medina. Ed Medina was the director. He also worked with Henson and at the Henson Workshop and did a number of things for Disney, too. And I want to just give my regards to him and his family. And it's a great loss. So that's what we've got so far.
So, you know, my own show next week, but on Saturday, on the 8th instead of on the 7th, at 1 p.m., Hugh Kenneth David and Bill Reynolds will be joining me for a discussion of the Danish series, Borgen, a political drama which ran for 3 seasons and seemed to come to a pretty nice little end. Until Netflix decided to bring it back. And had it not been for COVID, we'd already have that season. But because of that, it's been delayed until sometime next year. And it's now all available, seasons 1, 2, and 3, on Netflix. If you like political drama, if you like just great work, if you like something that's got just the right amount of dark humor in it, if you are a fan of The West Wing or The Thick of It, watch this show. Sidsy Babbitt Newton, I can't remember, I cannot say the name right now. The lady that plays the main character there, wonderful actress. Absolutely wonderful actress. Sidsy Babbitt Knudsen. There. I finally fucking said it.
There you go. We're proud of you, Adam.
I couldn't say it today. But, yeah, that's going to be that. And sometime in May, the exact time is up in the air, but we will be having an episode on the films of director Spike Lee.
Oh, I got to talk to you about that, by the way. Got to talk to you about that.
That's going to be a very interesting one, especially if I can maintain this one guest that I'm not at liberty to say who I may be able to get, but unless that falls through, that is absolutely the plan.
Cool.
So that's me teasing May. Carl, is there anything about this show, Fosse Verdon, that we haven't covered that you want to say really quickly?
Yeah, I do. There's one other thing, too. I think one of the legacies of Bob Fosse is that he took musicals and Broadway musicals and made them much more dark and much more, I won't say realistic, but to have much more real emotion to them. And I think he's a real progenitor for someone like Stephen Sondheim. I don't think without Fosse, Sondheim would have had the effect that he did. And I wanted to say that in those terms. I think he had such an incredible effect on Broadway, on how we view Broadway and how we look at this. That to me is very important. So that's the one thing I wanted to say, make sure to say that.
Yeah. And, I have to say that it wasn't really brought up here in the series. But, people don't talk about him in terms of this. But Bob Fosse was part of that new Hollywood. He wasn't necessarily, doing the stuff that Altman or Bogdanovich or that crowd were doing, but he was definitely part of that era and able to do work because of how the studios were desperate for anything at that point. Let's be honest, it wasn't just that the studios were open, it was that the studios were pretty fucking desperate. That we were able to get so much experimentation. But that is one thing that the show didn't really hit on that I wish they had. But again, perhaps source material issues. And, of course, any historian knows that there's only so much you can put into any account. So, Aaron?
I think that I guess I'll just stick with with this theme, I guess. I think they hit on that new Hollywood angle the best at sideways angles when they were mentioning Cabaret being up against The Godfather at the Oscars, or when they were talking about Dustin Hoffman going to star in Lenny, or how Richard Dreyfuss had to drop out of all that jazz because of another thing he was signed up to do. So there are oblique mentions to important figures in New Hollywood without just going into the history of New Hollywood, which this wasn't. This was a history of a guy who started on Broadway and brought that aesthetic to Hollywood.
To the film.
As part of that experimental age. So I guess I'll add that as my last thing to add.
Yeah. So, I think that basically sums up everything I think we have to say about it. Great show. If you haven't seen it, folks, and it sounds like something you'd be interested in, sure, go watch it. I believe Hulu still has it.
Yeah,
I know it's
Hulu
available on iTunes.
Has it because that's where I watched it. No,
yep.
It's Hulu.
But I know that Amazon and iTunes have it for rent and purchase. It's on disc. The FX streaming service may still have it. I'm not sure about that, but I know the other ones do. So, you know, this thing is available, and please, please do watch it. So, as always, thank you for listening. Thank you guys for coming on and speaking. And see you next week, folks. So with that, 1, 2, 3, good night.
Good night.
Good night.